PRI, Public Radio International. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
I wouldn't encourage my son to climb because this is a very dangerous job. You can have 100 reasons to die up here.
That's one of the Sherpas who works on Mount Everest. It's the 50th anniversary of Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay's historic first ascent. Today, we'll talk about the people who climb Everest. Also, the story of a man so obsessed with greatness that he carved four giant heads into the side of a mountain, creating a monument at Mount Rushmore. And the dramatic tale of Krakatoa, the deadliest volcano in history.
Without warning, it suddenly and cataclysmically exploded. 6 cubic miles of the island were thrown about 25 miles into the atmosphere in one enormous explosion.
Oh, 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 the mountain's gonna blow. Oh, 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 the lava's gonna flow. Oh, 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 ash is gonna rise. Oh, 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 there were pieces of the mountain in your eyes, up your nose and down your chest, little bit deeper on every breath. She don't care your point of view, now the mountain's part of you. Rumble!
Some years back, Peter Hillary and a few buddies were climbing the treacherous west ridge of Mount Everest. Few climbers have ever made it to the top along that route. Then, disaster struck.
And suddenly the weather at 27,000 feet started changing. Strong winds started blowing in on us. So 4 of us turned around to start coming down. And sadly, one of them tripped. We were all soloing, just with our axes and our crampons on our boots. And he just flew past my shoulder. I was very lucky he didn't hit me, in fact. But there was nothing we could do for him. So I turned around to start coming back up again. And then, to my absolute horror, I heard this sort of thudding sound, a bit like, you know, when stones skip across the water. And I looked up, and my great old climbing buddy, Fred Fromm, from Queensland, Australia, was just flying through the air at 80 miles an hour. And he just skipped past me and disappeared down the north face.
That's a scene from the documentary film Surviving Everest. Peter Hillary is the son of Sir Edmund Hillary. He and the great Sherpa Tenzing Norgay were the first men to summit Mount Everest. 50 years later, National Geographic sponsored a new expedition with the sons of those original climbers. Both Peter Hillary and Jamling Norgay are experienced climbers. In fact, Jamling was on the famous IMAX expedition in 96, when 9 climbers died on Everest. After that disaster, Norgay promised his family that he'd never again go all the way to the top. Steve Paulson talked with Hillary and Norgay about their recent climb and what it's like to follow in the footsteps of their famous fathers. Jamling says his father actually tried to keep him off Everest.
You know, he never encouraged us to climb. When I asked him on several occasions to pull some strings so I can climb Everest, he flatly said no. You know, he said he climbed so we wouldn't have to.
He didn't want you to climb simply because it was so dangerous?
Yes, he didn't want us to climb for work. You know, most of the Sherpas that climb today are climbing because of work, to put bread and butter on the table for the family. And he did not want us to do that, so he wanted to give us the best education possible so we can continue our lives in some other careers.
Well, I can understand that. In the documentary, a number of Sherpas talk about how difficult their lives are.
From camp to base, each Sherpa does it 15 to 20 times. And from camp to South Goal, each Sherpa does it around 10 times.
You will never see a Sherpa climbing this mountain out of pleasure. They climb because it's a livelihood.
It is very difficult for my children when I'm away. I'm usually away for several months.
So why did you end up climbing after all, in spite of your father's suggestions?
Well, I think it was my destiny to climb this mountain. I knew I was going to climb this mountain one day. You know, I did not know when. It was just a matter of time. I mean, I enjoy being in the outdoors, just being out there in the snow and rock and ice. You know, it's a great feeling.
Peter, what about you? Did you grow up climbing mountains?
Well, I certainly did. I mean, the Hillary family was a very outdoor family. In our school holidays, we always went camping and adventuring, skiing, climbing. As I grew older, I started developing my own interest in climbing and started off climbing rocks and graduated to the Southern Alps in New Zealand. And by the time I was in my mid-20s, I had started climbing in the Himalayas and already was starting to think maybe I would, after all, go to Mount Everest myself.
Tell me about your climb on Everest in the year 2002. How difficult was this?
Look, a climb of Everest is a difficult undertaking. It is a colossus, the highest mountain on Earth. It's over 29,000 feet high. It penetrates into the jet stream. You have to acclimatize slowly but surely over the many weeks that you're climbing on the mountain so that you can, in fact, climb to these extreme elevations. I mean, to give you an idea that, in fact, if we were lifted in a decompression chamber to 29,000 feet, we would remain conscious for around 90 seconds before sort of blacking out and falling down on the floor. I mean, that's the atmosphere that you're moving in up there, and your body needs a lot of time to adjust, to acclimatize to that sort of elevation. But it is a very steep and exposed climb. Much of the climb, all you'd have to do is make one tiny mistake, and in 1 second you'll be flying through the air and there'll be no coming back.
What kinds of mistakes do you have to watch out for? I mean, just a wrong step here or there?
Well, absolutely. A wrong step, hooking your feet together with your crampon boots, not clipping into the rope correctly. And in fact, a British climber did exactly that when we were on the mountain. He was up at Camp 3 at 24,000 feet, wasn't properly clipped onto the rope, and he slipped. And literally on this boilerplate, hard, blue-green ice, you've got 1 second to arrest the fall, and he failed to do that. And then you're suddenly accelerating as you bound down the face, getting faster and faster until you're just flying. And sadly, he died.
Now, one thing that I really appreciated about this film, Surviving Everest, was its depiction of the role of Sherpas. Basically, without the Sherpas, it would be impossible to climb Everest. And I'm wondering if you can explain the role that they play in these expeditions on Everest.
Sherpas are basically sort of the unsung heroes of Everest and the Himalayas, because Sherpas do all the work on the mountain, from fixing the ropes, the lines, the ladders, carrying supplies, stocking all the supplies to the high camps.
And they carry incredible loads.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these people carry up to, some of them carry about 60 kilos, 40 kilos down below. And on the mountain, they carry maybe about 25 kilos. And which is a lot of weight, you know, especially thinking about climbing above 26,000 feet, where there's only 1/3 of the oxygen that's down here at sea level. You know, like my father once said, that climbing up there above these mountains, you know, it's almost like putting a garbage bag over your head and running the marathon down here.
Now, there's a lot of lore about Everest among the Sherpas in particular. I mean, this mountain is really considered a living being, isn't it?
Yes, we believe in, for centuries, Everest is what we call Chomo Longma, or the Mother Goddess of the World. It's a very holy mountain for us. We believe that mountains are the places where the gods live. They're very sacred. We have religious ceremonies that we perform to most of these mountains every year. When we climb, you don't conquer these mountains. The mountain will let you on it and then give you a slight opportunity to be on the summit. And then you have to get out of there as soon as possible.
Now, Peter, there are scenes in this documentary film where it really shows how rough it is to climb Everest. I mean, partly it's an endurance test, partly it's a matter of dealing with food that might be bad and dealing with weather that sweeps in. And you got pretty sick at one point, didn't you?
Yes, I had some sort of gastroenteritis, and then I was very sick, and I became hypothermic and dehydrated, and was probably quite affected by the altitude.
I don't know how many times I went out to vomit. It sounded like it was all dry heaves. I must admit, when I called out to you, I was pretty scared.
Yeah, oh, f***ing A. Anyone would be. Yeah, we'll get you through this.
But that's all part of it, you know. I mean, one of the things about climbing this mountain is that it's not easy. I mean, really, that's part of the drive to go up there. You are going to have to deal with illness and discomforts and not wanting to eat, not being able to sleep. And I think it's the uncertainty of the mission that really is so attractive about going on a great climb, particularly on the world's greatest mountain, Mount Everest. In fact, after our first attempt when we got knocked back, you know, we weren't sure if we were going to make it. Our film crew had nearly been killed in the ice fall with these massive collapsing blocks of ice. And there was a lot of talk about what we should do.
There's an unbelievable scene in the film of showing the winds whipping one of the camps. And I guess the winds were up to around 60 miles an hour, just flattening some of the tents.
Well, look, they certainly were. I mean, there were some very strong winds in that storm. In fact, they got up to about 80 knots. But you need to remember that, you know, again, we're on a mountain whose summit is at 29,000 feet. And the jet stream winds that blast over the top of it from time to time can blow on occasion up to 300 knots. That's about 380 miles an hour. So, you know, you've got to be in the right place at the right time on this mountain. You certainly can't be caught out when it gets up into those sort of speeds.
It's incredible. You know, the wind that's blowing up towards the summit, you can hear it roaring down at Camp 2 at 21,000 feet. You know, we usually call it sort of the train. We always say whether the train is running today or not, because the sound of it sounds like a, you know, train just zipping through this place.
What's it like when you get near the top? I mean, the last few thousand feet. How difficult is it to walk at that point?
It's a pretty oxygen-deprived environment. You are quite hypoxic. People literally take steps one or two or three at a time, and then they just sort of lumber forward onto their ice axes, leaning there, hyperventilating deeply in that very rarefied air. Your thought processes, every process, is similarly retarded. You know, you've just got no energy left. You haven't slept properly for many, many days. But something inside you just keeps you going. It's that determination that you are going to keep forging higher onto the summit of the mountain. And I must say, when you do get up there, it is an incredible moment. I must say, it was very emotional for me.
Well, there's this amazing scene, Peter, when you have reached the top and you have a phone with you and you call your dad, Edmund Hillary, one of the guys who first climbed Everest, and you talk with him when you're sitting on the summit.
Hello?
Dad, it's Peter. We're on the summit. Can you hear us?
Hello, are you there, Peter?
Well, we're on the summit of Everest. We've been here for 40 minutes.
Yeah, how was the Hillary step?
It's really steep and really exposed. And what you did, well, nearly 50 years ago, it's just incredible. I mean, we had fixed ropes all the way. You guys cut steps basically into the unknown and up that jolly Hillary step. Anyway, Dad, don't worry. I'm not going to do it again. You know, what I love about that is it's such an amazing contrast to what my father and Tenzing experienced back in 1953, and it shows just how much our world has changed, because those guys had to climb back down the mountain to tell their fellow climbers that, yes, they had reached the summit.
Well, the other thing that I found amazing is there are scenes when your party is nearing the summit and there is actually a fixed rope that you can hold on to along the ridge. I mean, obviously, it's still treacherous, but there is a rope there. And I was thinking back to what it must have been like for your two fathers when they went up there. I mean, obviously, there was none of this. It just looked incredibly treacherous.
Well, it is. It's a knife-edge ridge. I mean, if you slip, you will just fly into either Nepal. I mean, we're talking sort of geopolitical exposure here, either into Nepal or down the other side into Tibet, and there's no coming back from those falls.
What do you think was hardest for that first expedition, and I mean, the first one that made it in 53 that Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay were on? What was hardest about their climb?
I think the hardest thing was not knowing what lied ahead of them. They were basically walking into the unknown, pushing the limits. You know, today we can climb Everest because we know it's possible. How many liters, you know, per minute you need of oxygen, what kind of equipment you need, what kind of ropes are to be fixed up there.
And they had no map to go up the mountain. I mean, they didn't know
nothing.
What was ahead.
They just had to follow the ridge and go as high as possible, looking for the route to go up.
What I think was so amazing about it was, the spirit that these two guys had. They were both on fire. They were wonderful alpinists. They were incredibly good at what they were doing. They were very strong. But, you know, again, it's the most important thing is that motivation, the psychological component. And I think in many ways both our fathers were at a stage in their lives where they were almost unstoppable. This was their time, and they were going to the top. And, of course, the rest is history.
Peter Hillary and Jeanling Norgay talking with Steve Paulson. The documentary film Surviving Everest airs on the National Geographic Channel. Coming up, the story of history's deadliest volcano, Krakatoa, and how one man survived the monstrous tidal wave that killed thousands of people.
The wave towered over him, rushing towards him at between 200 and 300 miles an hour. And he saw, also being swept along, a crocodile. So he jumped on it and dug his thumbs into the crocodile's eye sockets and surfed for about 2 miles over the jungle until the wave abated and he ran like the devil and managed to escape.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. For centuries, Krakatoa was just a tiny blip on the map, an obscure volcanic island off the coast of Java. That all changed one day in 1883, when the volcano blew its top. It killed more people than any other volcano in history. The chaos that followed also sparked a militant Islamic movement in Indonesia. Best-selling writer Simon Winchester tells this story in his book, Krakatoa.
What happened, essentially, was that in May of 1883, it started smoking and erupting in a fairly dramatic but not a particularly notable way. I mean, it was making a nuisance of itself, if you like. And then, without warning, without any warning at all, at 2 minutes past 10 on the morning of Monday, the 27th of August, it suddenly and cataclysmically exploded. And in doing so, it completely annihilated itself. 6 cubic miles of the island, which was essentially all of the island, were thrown about 25 miles into the atmosphere in one enormous explosion. And this, for a few microseconds, left behind a gigantic hole in the sea, if you like, which at the bottom was red hot. Trillions of tons of seawater then cascaded in to fill the hole, and they immediately flashed into steam, which sent out a huge concentric ring of tidal waves, or tsunamis, which did most of the damage. These waves, there were 4 of them, and the biggest of them killed just over 36,000 people.
It's astonishing, the whole story. And there are a lot of different things to talk about. I want to sort of start at the beginning, because I think we all have a notion of what an exploding volcano is. In this country, we think about Mount St. Helens, which exploded not all that long ago, and we had a cloud that sailed across the country and caused some small climate change. Is the scale of these anything alike?
There is a similarity, yes. I mean, I happened by coincidence to be at Mount St. Helens when it erupted. I was working for an English newspaper at the time, and it was very, very dramatic, but nothing compared to the drama of Krakatoa. Volcanoes are measured in the same way that earthquakes are. Earthquakes have their Richter scale. Volcanoes have what's called the Volcanic Explosivity Index, the VEI, which is a multiple of the amount of material thrown out times the height to which it reaches in the atmosphere. And Krakatoa, with 6 cubic miles thrown 25 miles, is the 5th biggest in world history so far as the geological community can work out. The biggest of them was called Toba, T-O-B-A, which exploded about 250,000 years ago. Krakatoa is the fifth largest, and way, way down the scale would be a volcano like Mount St. Helens, which is just like a pop gun compared to Krakatoa. The sound of this paroxysmal event was, without a doubt, the largest sound ever generated on the planet since mankind has been around to hear it. Huge sound waves, which presumably go outwards at about 750 miles an hour, allowed this explosion to be heard in Australia and in India and Sri Lanka. As far away, the furthest, the most distant recorded record of this sound was in an island called Rodriguez Island off Mauritius, a British possession, where the local police chief heard what he thought was a distinct cannonade of what he assumed was naval gunfire off to the east. Well, that was 2,968 miles from Krakatoa.
Pulling back to right next to it, then, it must have been absolutely astonishing. I mean, not just loud, but terrifying.
Terrifying. I mean, the ships that were passing up and down the Sunda Strait between Java and Sumatra, which was then, as it is today, a very busy commercial waterway, were devastated. I mean, for a start, they were completely covered with ash and rock. Their sails were on fire. There was lightning coming from the yardarms. The men on board, most of them, something like 80% of all the ships passing through, they had their eardrums shattered. People lost their hearing for something like 100 miles around the volcano. Terrifying. But of course, volcanoes ride over the tidal waves. And so there was no great sinking, although one Dutch warship with, I think, a crew of 28 was physically picked up by one of these waves, carried 2.5 miles inland, and then dumped unceremoniously on a rocky ledge. And all 28 of the crew had their skulls shattered when they hit the upper decks. So there were some fatalities at sea, but most were on the land.
You talk about ash on the ships as well. I think I remember you, someone writing that the ash was 8 English thumbs deep.
A peculiar measurement, yes, but very deep. But one of the other bizarre things were these rafts of pumice. When the andesite rock filled with air came down and hit the sea, it floated, just like the pumice we use in our bathrooms today. But these weren't little nuggets of pumice. These were islands several miles in extent. And they caught up in them a lot of dead and dying people and animals. And something like a year later, a party of school children on Zanzibar, which is about 4,000 miles away from Krakatoa, came across a very large piece of pumice on one of their beaches, containing, sort of freighted all the way over the Indian Ocean, scores of skeletons of human beings and of Sumatran tigers.
What would it have been like to be right there? In fact, there were a couple of fishermen who were on Krakatoa, is that right?
A few people were very close and survived. I mean, one of the people whose accounts I think is quite remarkable was a German, I believe, who was on top of a large stone building, which itself was on a hill 100 feet high. The wave towered over him, rushing towards him at between 200 and 300 miles an hour, it's estimated. So it must have been a frightening thing to see. It completely demolished the building he was on, but it didn't kill him. It swept him along on the crest of the wave, and he looked to his right. He's very certain that he was to his right he was looking, and he saw, also being swept along, a crocodile. And with the kind of presence of mind that most of us couldn't imagine having, he decided he might survive if he leapt aboard the crocodile. So he jumped on it and dug his thumbs into the crocodile's eye sockets and surfed for about 2 miles over the jungle until the wave abated, let him and a very, very angry crocodile down among the palm trees, and he ran like the devil and managed to escape.
What an extraordinary story.
Probably not true, I have to say, but it's recorded, and so I thought, well, I'll at least note it down myself.
You know, whether it's true or not, it ought to be. What about after this? In addition to all of the environmental changes, there were social changes that came from this. When that extraordinary sound was heard, when the news of this explosion on the other side of the world was read in the papers, people both close to it and far away wondered whether this was God's wrath.
Yes, but looking at it in a sort of slightly more positive way, people all of a sudden, and sort of Boylston Street in Boston and down in Sydney and Melbourne and in London and in places where the people were completely unfamiliar with words like Java and Sumatra and Krakatoa and the Sunda Strait, suddenly were talking about them because the news was full of an event that had happened just the previous day. Did you see, they would say to each other, the news of this extraordinary explosion off Java? I like to think of this event as being the beginning, the starting point, if you like, for the creation of today's global village. It had an enormous social impact on the world.
In the communities nearer to it, I gather that there were also some spiritual side effects.
That, in a way, given our situation in the world at the moment, I think is almost the most interesting byproduct of Krakatoa. In the 18th century, Java and Sumatra were overwhelmingly Hindu. The only part of modern-day Indonesia that remains Hindu is, of course, Bali. But in those days, Java was Hindu. Muslims decided to put an end to this and to convert, as best they could, millions of people to Islam. The eruption occurred, and the mullahs, who had all come from southern Arabia, said this is undeniably a sign from Allah, a sign that the Mahdi, the Islamic Messiah, is coming, and he is extremely angry with you Javanese. And he's angry because, and this was a very shrewd move on the mullah's part, he's angry because you are allowing yourselves to be ruled by white Western Dutch imperialists. Rise up and kill them. And so they did, or at least they attempted to, and 5 years later, but essentially triggered by the events on this volcano, an enormous rebellion was fomented, which resulted in the deaths at the hands of Islamic militants of scores of Dutch men and women and children. The Dutch military came in, put the rebellion down, but it was the beginning of the end for Dutch rule. It was the beginning of the creation of what is today's largest Islamic state on earth, Indonesia. It was the first eruption, and I don't mean that as a pun, of militant anti-Western Islamic behavior anywhere in the world. And the final interesting, intellectually interesting aspect of this is that the mullahs that were in Java converting people all came from that one part of the southern Arabian Peninsula known as the Hadramaut, modern-day Yemen, if you like, from where comes Osama bin Laden. So there are parallels which I think are beguiling.
Simon Winchester's book is called Krakatoa, The Day the World Exploded, August 27th, 1883. Over the years, volcanoes have inspired plenty of strange stories. One of the more poignant ones came out of the Mount St. Helens eruption. It made a folk hero out of a cantankerous mountain man named Harry Truman.
He lived up there since 29. Run a lodge and filled his time drinking whiskey, raising cats, and telling big tall tales. The mountain home he had was shaking like the earth gone mad. When they warned him, he said, "No, I think I'll stay. 'Cause if the mountain goes, then I'll go with it. If the mountain goes, I'll go along. If the mountain I'll go with it. I'm gonna stay right here, 'cause here's where I belong." Then on May 18th, St. Helens blew, tore the mountain right in two. With trees ripped up, clouds of ash, the earth was glowing red. As for Harry, no one knows. He's up there still, so the legend goes, while the newspapers list him missing, presumed dead. And if the mountain goes...
That's Tom Hunter singing Harry Truman of Mount St. Helens. Coming up, the story of Mount Rushmore and the man who created this patriotic monument.
The part of Borglum's life we're not supposed to talk about, this is the sculptor of our shrine of democracy after all, is the fact that right before Borglum came to South Dakota to carve Mount Rushmore, He was an active and ardent member of the Ku Klux Klan.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We've been talking this hour about the splendor and the unpredictability of mountains. They are symbols of untamed wilderness. But some mountains have been tamed, or at least carved up. Take Mount Rushmore in South Dakota, that shrine to American democracy. Now, when you think about it, carving four giant heads into the side of a mountain is a kind of a bizarre idea. But then you have to understand the guy who did it. Gutzon Borglum was a larger-than-life figure, a man who not only believed in the great man theory of history, he considered himself one. John Tolliver tells the story of Mount Rushmore's creation in his book Great White Fathers. He told Ann Strangehamps that the idea first came from business boosters in South Dakota.
The Black Hills didn't have an Old Faithful, an El Capitan, so these business leaders said, well, how can we get people to steer their cars our way and bring some of their money with them? Someone had the idea, well, why don't we get somebody to carve something on the side of a mountain. We don't really care what it is. And they contacted one of the preeminent sculptors of the day, a man named Gutzon Borglum, this irascible, egomaniacal artist who had been working on a Confederate memorial on Stone Mountain, Georgia. And he said, sure, but I'd like to make it a national memorial. Let's not make it just a kind of a kitschy thing. Let's make it a sober, dignified memorial to American civilization. A shrine of democracy.
But it would take some kind of hubris or some, you know, driving ambition to think that you could carve sculptures this size into the side of a mountain.
Enormous hubris, just unapologetic hubris. Of course, in the 1920s, when Mount Rushmore was conceived, people were thinking colossally anyway, the big bridges and the big dams. The skyscrapers were beginning, the Titanic and the big ships had been built, so the idea that carving should be on the same scale seemed almost patriotic. Borglum also had extraordinary energy. He carved Mount Rushmore into his 60s. He would strap on that harness and climb down the side of that 500-foot cliff himself, grab a jackhammer, swing around like a mountain goat. Then he would rush off the mountain and drive several miles away, sort of like a painter would back off from his canvas and study a little nuance here, a shadow there, and rush back on the mountain, climb up again. Extraordinary energy. He'd have done the whole thing himself if he could have.
It's sort of an unsavory side to him as well, with some of that energy. I think somewhere in your book he notes to a friend that he'd stayed up half the night writing 3,000 words about the evils of alien races. And he had a connection to the Ku Klux Klan too, right?
Yeah, the part of Borglum's life we're not supposed to talk about. This is the sculptor of our shrine of democracy, after all, along with the Statue of Liberty, the great symbol of our American Republic. The part we're not supposed to talk about is the fact that right before Borglum came to South Dakota to carve Mount Rushmore, he was an active and ardent member of the reemerging Ku Klux Klan. And he wasn't just sympathetic to the Klan, he was right into the thick of the Klan leadership. And in fact, it was some of his internal squabbles with the Klan elite that drove him out of Georgia and induced him to come to South Dakota. And the National Park Service, in its presentation of Borglum and Mount Rushmore, doesn't like to dwell on the fact that it was a Klansman who built Mount Rushmore. Mm.
So there's this unsavory whiff of racism behind Mount Rushmore. Also, Mount Rushmore had been considered by the Lakota Sioux a very sacred mountain, and it was a kind of sacrilege that white Americans built this monument to their patriotic fathers.
Yes, that's true. There were several protests in the 1970s at the height of the American Indian movement where Indians came and took over Mount Rushmore and hung banners from it and threatened to spread red paint on it. The Black Hills are the heart of everything that is, in the words of the Lakota Sioux. This is their Eden. They believe their people were born from the rock of the Black Hills. The mountain that Mount Rushmore is on is the equivalent of the Temple Mount. And so, having been driven from the Black Hills illegally, many Lakota Sioux and many Native Americans resent the fact that these four glowering white fathers are up there on their most sacred ground, almost as guardians to keep them away. And they won't settle. They want the Black Hills back.
Was Borglum aware of this at the time? I mean, how did he respond?
Borglum was aware that the Black Hills were sacred, and he was a friend of Indians and very understanding of them, although I'm not sure he understood the depth of their spiritual convictions. It was Borglum who brought Indians in when they had various dedication ceremonies, completion of the Washington face or the Jefferson face, and they'd bring in the Indians to give invocations and bang drums and do a little dance. And he was sympathetic to the cause of the Indians on the reservation. Did he consider stopping what he was doing? No way.
What a contradictory man, a member of the KKK and yet sympathetic to the Native Americans.
Well, great men are often a bundle of contradictions, you know, and patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel.
Tell me about the actual creation of Mount Rushmore. You mentioned earlier that Borglum had been strapped to a little chair or something. I mean, how risky, how dangerous was it to actually carve the whole thing?
Well, the creation of Mount Rushmore is an epic story, and it is a wonderful story. Borglum went looking for people to do the work, and there were a lot of out-of-work miners, hard rock miners, who lived in the neighboring towns. So we rounded them up. None of them knew much about art, and certainly none of them had ever carved anything. They just were strong guys who could handle a drill. And he had to come up with a system that they could follow. So he built a model of Mount Rushmore, 1 inch to the foot. He did the carvings of the four faces. So when he wanted to carve the nose of George Washington, say, he would put a little measuring device on top of the model and say, okay, go down this many inches and start drilling this much there, and then he would multiply by 12 and send these guys hanging by cables off the side of the mountain to start whacking away.
Well, I can't imagine you'd have much control either. I mean, we're talking about fairly precise shapes. I mean, these are, you know, eyes and noses, nostrils, the, you know, sharp curve of a lip. How do you do that with a jackhammer?
Inch by inch. They figured out how to use dynamite with these very small charges, and they could blast just an inch or two off of the surface with dynamite. They used it very delicately, almost like a laser. It's remarkable. Now, you're right. It was incredibly difficult, which makes the result that much more remarkable, because the amazing thing about Mount Rushmore, it isn't rudimentary. It isn't primitive. These are fine sculptures with real character. The faces have expressions. The lip of Thomas Jefferson looks like it's just about to curl into a smile. Teddy Roosevelt's eyeglasses, you think there's glass in them because Borglum carved just the little imprint of the glass frames around Roosevelt's cheeks and brow.
Borglum had hopes, I guess, that this huge monument would be, oh, this kind of great emblem of American civilization. I think he said that he hoped that 10,000 years from now, when archaeologists came upon Mount Rushmore, they'd get this immediate understanding of American civilization. Do you think Mount Rushmore does that?
Absolutely. Borglum liked the scale of Mount Rushmore. He compared it to the Sphinx or the pyramid because he wanted our civilization to be measured with the same ruler as the great ancient civilizations. It's a different experience when you walk up close to Mount Rushmore and you're surrounded by those four faces. It is awe-inspiring. It will melt the cynicism of almost any visitor and stir the patriotism of the most cynical American.
John Tolliver is the author of Great White Fathers, the story of the obsessive quest to create Mount Rushmore. He spoke with Anne Strangchamps. Mark Sprague grew up in the mountains of Wyoming. Horses were his constant companions. Here's Sprague with an excerpt from his memoir, Where Rivers Change Directions.
I knew the horses as I knew my family. When I was separated from them, I felt wrong in the world. When I was separated from them, I took no comfort in the sound of the creek. I felt chilled without the heat of them. In the short lulls between rides, I leaned against the corrals, watching them roll like some captured pod of smallish whales, multicolored, snorting at their handicapped buoyancy. When I stepped in among them, they would turn to me, roll their eyes until the white showed, flick their ears. They were used to the sight and sound of me. I was the boy who straddled their hearts.
Mark Sprague grew up on Holm Lodge, the oldest dude ranch in Wyoming. He told Steve Paulson that just a few decades ago, life in the American West was very different from what we all take for granted today.
When we first moved to Holm Lodge, it was on a generator. It took the first year to get hooked up to the Rural Electric Association. No television reception, no radio reception. We were too far back in the mountains. 20-mile ride to a one-room schoolhouse. There were all of four kids in the upper 25 miles of the Wapiti Valley. And surrounded, I mean firmly, 20 miles inside the Shoshone National Forest, which is adjacent to Yellowstone National Park and the other national forests that surround the park. So there were 12 million square miles of wilderness area.
And to put this in perspective, this was the 60s that we're talking about. I mean, there was a lot of stuff happening out there in the world, but you were really cut off from all of that.
It was a monster shock to me when I went to college in 1970 and found the Beatles and the certainly I knew about the Vietnam War, but hadn't seen it broadcast on television every night, and grew up more a student of history and literature. My dad had a fine library of a lot of history, a lot of philosophy, some good novels. So from the time we were 8 years old, he would assign a book every month. And they weren't easy reading. They were Rousseau, Kant, Kierkegaard.
Wow. So from the time you were 8 years old?
Yeah. And we were required to read one every month. And then after dinner, we would stand at the far end of the dining table and give him an oral report on the book. The written report was due the week after that.
Well, you write about how the environment that you grew up in really didn't put too much stock in childhood, this protected, innocent little time of one's life. I mean, you were being groomed from very early on to be a man.
Children, quite frankly, weren't very useful. Childhood was seen largely as an apprenticeship, I think. We had to contribute with whatever work we felt comfortable and capable of doing.
So what did you do? What kinds of tasks were you put to?
Well, I lived in the bunkhouse with the older cowboys, who seemed very old to me at the time. They were men in their late 40s to late 50s.
And how old were you?
I started when I was 11.
What did they think of you, this little kid?
Well, one of my favorite old cowboys that raised me called me Little Man, which should be indicative of what he expected of me, that I was a smallish man or a man in training, as it were. And to grow up and try to do as many tasks as I could around the ranch. When I say they were democratic, they really did not care whether you were short, tall, fat, thin, female, male. They did care that you kept your word, that you got up early, that you worked late, and that you could be counted upon.
And this was a dude ranch that your father ran. So people from all over the place would come and you would take them out into the hills to see the mountains.
People from around the world. That was the only thing that really probably completely mitigated the isolation in which I grew up. We had people largely from Europe, occasionally from South America, from both coasts of this country, the Midwest, the South. What was lovely to see, and I find that now as an adult, I'm very comfortable with almost anyone, because we would take up to 30 or 40 people into the mountains for up to 3 weeks. So they would not see another human being or road or a power line. And you watch them all sort of deconstruct into just a primary man and a primary woman. And some of them were enormously kind. Some of them were wonderfully helpful. Some of them were selfish, but not very many of them. And it allowed me to grow up with the notion that we're all pretty primarily the same, regardless of whether we're a judge from Connecticut or a farmer from Iowa.
Well, you write about how you and your brother, I think you were 15, your brother a year younger, would lead some of these trips yourselves for days at a time. I mean, here you were, I mean, leading out a lot of people a lot older than you, and it was just the two of you, these teenagers.
Yeah, we felt very comfortable doing it, but I've thought about it as an adult, and I can only imagine the terror that must have run through some of those young fathers to be standing there in the tack shed with perhaps their small children who weren't that much younger than my brother and myself and his wife. And here's these two children. They're about to take him out into the wilderness for 2 weeks, slipping a carbine in the saddle scabbard in case of grizzly bears and that sort of thing. It must have been terrifying for them. It wasn't for us. I do know that when we brought them back safely, we always got a big tip. They were very appreciative.
So you felt totally confident about your ability to survive, not only survive, but to look after all these people when you were out in the mountains on horseback.
Yeah, I did. My only anxiety was that I might disappoint my father, that if something happened, if a horse went down in a river and someone were to get hurt or even killed, that actually it was more frightening to me in that I might kill someone that I would have to come home and tell my father that that I had failed and that the business was about to suffer in dramatic ways.
Well, and there are some poignant moments that you write about. For instance, there was one time you noticed that the horse that you were on seemed a little off, but you still took that horse out and it almost didn't make it on the way back.
That was bad judgment on my part. And there again, wanting to prove to be a man, and in fact, by doing that, acting more childish than anyone.
So what happened?
Had I been completely mature, I would have known that that horse was too ill to carry on. We had a 30-mile ride over the Continental Divide to get back to the lodge, and the horse could not make it and got very ill. It was very perilous. We thought he might die, and I was required to spend the night with him while the rest of the pack string went on to the lodge, and I brought him in the next day.
So in the end, you walked the horse back to the ranch?
Yeah, I did. There was about 12 miles left, and I walked him in, weeping, I must admit, for a large part of the journey because I felt I'd been set back. I felt that I wasn't progressing toward the grown-up world, that I was falling away from it again.
Did you ever have to shoot a horse?
Yeah, a couple of times. There's one specific incident where I had to shoot a horse that was very dear to me. It was a horse that I had ridden every summer for several years, and he had been badly wire cut. And I think I was 15 at the time, and certainly my father would have shouldered that for me, but he couldn't be there that day. Certainly I suffered doing it, but it was better that I suffer for a day than that horse suffer interminably in its pain and confusion. In a business in which I grew up, you took care of all of the animals before you took care of yourself. Even after, say, the 30-mile ride over the Continental Divide in and into the lodge, and some of it in atrocious weather where your hands were stiffened to the point where you couldn't close them into fists and you were soaked through when you got in, you made sure that all the horses, if there were 80 or 90 or 100 of them, were well cared for before you took any sort of break for yourself.
You also write about some harrowing experiences. There was a time when you were 13 and you were out with an older guy hunting elk, and he ended up slicing his hand quite badly, and he really needed your help.
Yeah. You know, in writing about these incidents, what seems harrowing, I mean, we worked with over 100 horses. We worked a good long way from town. My mother had been a nurse. I've had over 200 stitches, and she gave me most of them before I was 20 years old because going to town was too much of a waste of the day. And so we were accustomed to people getting hurt.
What happened to this guy?
He had a very sharp knife and was opening an elk that he had killed on a bad side hill and slipped and nearly severed his smallest finger from his hand and at the meat of his hand, the heel there.
So what did he have you do?
Well, we finished the job cleaning and quartering the elk. And
so even though his finger was dangling there, he wanted to
Yeah, that was the type of man that I grew up with. You finished the job, whether it was caring for horses or, I mean, had we not gutted that elk and opened it up for the night, it would have spoiled, which would have been the waste of the killing of an animal, which is no small thing. That animal provided us with the protein to get through that winter. But we got back to our camp, and he had a few drinks from a bottle of whiskey he had, and then we had an aerosol can of, I still don't know what it's called. I'm 50 years old, and I still refer to it as purple horse medicine. That was the color of it, and it stained things horribly when you sprayed it on. But I sprayed the hand with that, and I can only imagine how deeply that must have stung and hurt, and then bound the hand up, and he had a very bad night, and we packed up the elk the next morning and rode the 12 miles to the ranch.
Mark Sprague, talking with Steve Paulson. Where Rivers Change Direction is the title of Sprague's memoir. He's also written a novel called The Fruit of Stone.
I'm one of the few. I'm proud to be standing. I walked up the pier from the coffin ship's landing. My clothes were just rags. No use for this weather, but my back was strong, my hands tough as leather. I climbed up these hills till I came to the spot where I stand. I cleared these fields and I pulled up the stumps with my hands. No more a wanderer, no more a refugee. Mountaineer is always free.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for the program Mountain Splendor, number 511A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, Anne Strain Champs, and Mary Lou Finnegan, with engineering help from Marv Nunn.
PRI. Public Radio International.
Is it any wonder boys don't read? Too often they're assigned the books their female teachers loved. Next week on To the Best of Our Knowledge, the man behind the Guys Read website says forget Little House on the Prairie and bring on Stinky Cheese Man. Boys and the Men They Become on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.